Audio conversation with Eric Wargo, recorded Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. Eric's first book, Time Loops, was published in 2018, and his latest book will be published very soon, and it might be out and available by the time you are hearing these words. This newer book is titled From Nowhere, with the subtitle Artists, Writers, and the Precognitive Imagination. This book is all about the mysteries of the creative process and how retrocausality and time loops might account for those moments of inspirations that are central to making art. He also published a third book, and that one came out in 2021, and it is titled Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self, Interpreting Messages from Your Future. So in this show, we're sort of covering all the books, and what we discuss is an overlapping set of ideas that include time, inspiration, and dreams. I feel like I should define a few things before the interview starts, because we jumped right into it when we began talking, and we kind of skipped over maybe some foundational things. Okay, first, Eric sort of looks at a model of the universe that he visualizes as a glass football. I am paraphrasing from something that I heard him share on another podcast. Okay, so this football, at one end is the Big Bang. And then if you travel the interior of the football, it widens out, and that traveling through the length of the football is essentially traveling through time, or let's say the illusion of time. So this football is pinched down at one end, and that's the Big Bang, and then you move through the interior of this big glass football, and at the other end is where the universe crunches back down, sort of the mirrored opposite of the Big Bang, where it expands at one end and shrinks in the other. Now, this football is sort of representing not our three-dimensional reality, but let's say a richer, more complex four-dimensional reality. So in the middle of this football are strands of consciousness stretching from the Big Bang to the end of the universe, and that would be at the other end. And Eric uses the term the long self to describe our consciousness as something beyond this simplistic 3D reality that we can comprehend all around us in this physical realm. So, our lives, our multiple lives, our eternal life is stretched out forwards and backwards within this glass football, and this is what he calls the long self, our long self. So that's us, each one of us, along this seemingly endless length of consciousness. Our future self is out there. It is out forward, ahead of us in time, and it can influence our present self here in time. And it can do that through a sort of inspiration or a moment of knowing. And this can happen in dreams or flashes of inspiration. Terms like retrocausality, precognition, premonition, and déjà vu would all fit this speculative model. Okay, I had to share that because we get right into it in the conversation, and so this is the foundation for what we're about to talk about. And let me say, this was a really strong conversation, and both of us shared a lot of examples of what has been showing up in our work that reflects this long self. And many of those are personal experiences. Okay, before I start the interview, one thing I need to point out. For some reason, my side of the conversation ended up with occasional little clicks and some dropouts in the audio. I did my very best to clean those up, but you as the listener will certainly hear a few jumps in the audio quality in my side of the conversation. This shouldn't really affect your listening, but I wanted to give you a heads up. Our conversation runs about an hour and 20 minutes, and this would be episode 3 in the new incarnation of the Hidden Experience podcast. Please enjoy. Eric, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Mike, for having me. This is going to be great. really looking forward to talking to you.
Great, good. So your work and my impression of it is there is a blurring between dreams, the unconscious, creativity, and premonitions, and all of it is somehow bound up in the mystery of time. Would that be an accurate interpretation?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think, so, you know, the subject of my work in one word is precognition is the, you know, it's not my favorite word, but it's a term that people, you know, people understand when you say it, and it's, you know, familiar from science fiction and in parapsychology, it's a word that's been in use for about a century now. So I stick with it. I mean, it's not a pretty word. I sometimes, you know, like, I think the word premonition is a little bit more poetic, but that word often has connotations, negative connotations, like, you know, it's associated with premonitions of death and disaster. You know, you don't have a premonition of, you know, your sink backing up or something trivial like that. And most precognitive experiences, you know, 99% of them are about, you know, relatively mundane experiences in daily life. And the term prophecy is one that I use a lot in my new book, simply because, you know, when we're talking about the arts, that's a term that people will often use to talk about novels and films and TV shows that seem to predict future events. But it all, these various terms all fall under the rubric of precognition.
Okay. So your new book, From Nowhere, is about creativity and the mystery of inspiration. And you're an academic by training and by profession. And I'm an artist by, like, I didn't have a choice, let me put it that way. And so I see academic as something being very tidy, and the creative process is really messy.
I'm actually not an academic by profession. I got my PhD and immediately left academia because it was not a place for me for various reasons. So I became a science writer. And I happen now to work for a large government institute doing science writing, but I'm not I've worked for various magazines and things like that. I'm not an academic in my daily life, but I sort of, you know, imitate the academic mode when it suits me. And in my books, I sort of take an academic approach to these topics, but not in a narrow way that someone who actually had to worry about tenure and things like that would be taking.
But you know how to do footnotes.
I know how to do footnotes. Okay. I'm very good at doing footnotes, and my editor really hates me because I'm really a stickler for getting things right in footnotes. And
do you know Joshua?
I'm sorry, who? You cut out there briefly.
Joshua Cutchin. He wrote a book called Ecology of Souls.
Yeah. We've met a few times at there's a local event. In Baltimore that I used to attend, and he's spoken there at least once, and we've spoken, and I certainly know his work. I've got all of his books back here on my paranormal shelf.
I did the layout for one of his books. This is sort of an aside, but I did the layout for one of his books. It has 2,500 footnotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now he's a serious, he's in that same vein. I don't think he's an academic in his daily life, but he's definitely an academic in his work. Very, very, very strong researcher and carefully cites his sources. And I appreciate that about Josh.
He would qualify as a creative type. He's an artist. He's a classically trained tuba player.
Right.
So you have a blog. And on the masthead of your blog is a flying saucer. But UFOs don't show up much in your books. A little bit, but not much. So just fill me in on that.
Well, this all got started with a UFO sighting in 2009, July 4th, 2009. And I actually talk about this in the afterword of my new book. It wasn't anything spectacular. Just dancing orange orbs over the Philadelphia Art Museum. Okay, Philadelphia Museum of Art. And I reported it to MUFON the next day. I didn't really know much about the UFO topic at that point. But I found out that other people had seen the same thing in the same part of the country the same night. And it got me to do my due diligence, as I always say, and read up on the topic, and sort of sent me down that rabbit hole of ufology that people go down, and I'm sure you're familiar with it. And the thing is, like a lot of people who really get into UFOs, it's very exciting for a while, but then it can get really disillusioning, and it's such a quagmire of, on the one hand, you know, real credulous people who are true believers of some belief system having to do with UFOs that is not very, you know, rigorous or scientific. And on the other hand, deception, disinformation, you know, government cover-ups, government psyops, and just, it's such a mess. And so I sort of distanced myself from the UFO topic, but like anyone else who gets into ufology, you wind up reading the works of Jacques Vallée and John Keel and people who are pointing out this really interesting overlap of UFO encounters and psychic phenomena. And I'm a scientifically trained person. And psychic phenomena, if you are from the sciences at all, in fact, at the time I was working, I was editorial director for a big scientific psychology organization. And scientific psychologists are incredibly hostile to the idea of ESP and psychic phenomena. It's equivalent to pseudoscience for a lot of people in academia, especially psychology. So, you know, this was a big cognitive dissonance for me as a scientifically trained person working essentially in the field of psychology as an editor. And it forced me to read the research and read a lot about parapsychological research, the history of psychical research and parapsychological research of the 20th century, you know, the remote viewing stuff. And I realized, you know, there's something here and you can't ignore it, or I can't ignore it. And about the time that I was sort of having this kind of paradigm shift for myself, an article came across my desk at work, and it was a draft of an article that was about to be published in a rival psychology journal. Okay. And this was the now famous article, Feeling the Future, by Cornell psychologist Daryl Bem. Now, Daryl Bem is a big name in psychology, scientific psychology, very respected, solid researcher, did very important work in personality and a lot of other subjects. But interestingly, he had an interest in parapsychology, and that backstory is itself an interesting story. Maybe we could talk about it. But he wound up doing this big series of very large studies in the first decade of this century, where he would put Cornell undergraduates, large groups of Cornell undergraduates, in these paradigms that were sort of like twists or flips of typical psychology experiments, where he basically switched the order of stimulus and response, okay? And he discovered something impossible, which was that people, the participants, were pre-sponding to something in their future. And this was mind-blowing, but he got significant results, and this article was being published in, like I said, a rival journal. And our organization was so mad about this that we were going to write a letter, you know, this is preposterous. Things like this should not be published because they make psychology look bad. Things like that. So I got this firsthand taste of the stigma that attaches to psychic phenomena and ESP research in the field of psychology. But also, Daryl Bem's paper was really, really interesting and really mind-blowing. for instance, his most famous finding, and he actually talked about this on the Colbert Report when he was interviewed there. He had students sit in front of a computer screen, and they were supposed to guess which of two curtains on the computer screen had a picture behind it. Okay. Now, theoretically, they should perform 50% chance of guessing correctly. Okay. And that was how it worked. They were roughly 50% correct in guessing when the picture that was going to be revealed by the mouse click was boring. Okay. But when the picture that was revealed by the mouse click was erotic, they were more accurate than chance, significantly more accurate than chance. So somehow they were precognitively orienting towards an erotic stimulus, okay, on a computer screen. And to clarify, there was not actually a picture behind the curtains on the computer screen. It was randomly generated by the mouse click. So there was nothing, you know, this was not clairvoyance. This was clearly a form of precognition. And in another set of experiments, he showed participants a word list, okay, and then tested them on the words on that list. But then, after the test, he reinforced some of the words on the list with a subsequent, task. Well, the students somehow did better on that test on the words that they subsequently were reinforced for. Okay, which, and again, somehow they were being influenced by a stimulus that followed their response. Okay, and these kinds of findings, I mean, he got a lot of significant findings in this set of experiments that he did. And there were big experiments, and they were done very simply so that other labs could replicate them. And it's turned out that a lot of independent labs have replicated his findings successfully. So, you know, this is impossible from the standpoint of ordinary psychology and everything we think we know about the mind or the brain or whatever you want to call it. And so this really got me thinking. So this, coupled with what I was reading in Jacques Vallée's work and so on, forced me to really reconsider precognition. But guess what? I realized, you know, one of the main ways people experience precognition is in dreams. And I had just fortunately, coincidentally, been keeping a detailed dream journal for decades by that point. And I had, in fact, had those dreams, and I had swept them under the rug. This is what happens with so many people who experience whatever, you know, a UFO encounter, a ghost encounter, whatever, any kind of, you know, thing that falls outside the bounds of the possible. People often just, they don't have a mental container for it, so it just gets swept under the rug. And only later, maybe if they suddenly realize, oh, wait a minute, other people have these experiences, then do they maybe go back to their own experiences and reevaluate what happened? Well, I had recorded in my dream journal what I now knew were precognitive dreams, including a dream about 9/11, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so this was a big paradigm shift for me. And so I've essentially spent the last decade, more than a decade now, I guess 13 years, 14 years, studying precognition, both in my own life, but in the literature, I get hundreds, like you with your owls, I get, you know, emails every day from people sharing their dreams with me. And I've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of examples of this, and they're very, very consistent. Mm. That's the beauty of it. I mean, when you actually pay attention to this stuff, it's all very, very consistent. People's precognitive dreams are really consistent, and you can actually derive principles from them. And that's my second book, was essentially a guide to interpreting precognitive dreams, interpreting dreams from the point of view of possible precognition and how to identify precognition in your dreams. after I published my first book, had a chapter on dreams and it had examples of dreams in it, but it wasn't mainly about the topic of dreams. It was sort of more about precognition generally in dreams, creativity, and also the possible physics and biology of it and so on. But people kept coming up to me after I would present on this material, and they would be telling me their dreams. And a big theme in the emails I was getting and in people coming up and sharing their stories with me was real, like, puzzlement and even trauma, because many people had had what they realized in hindsight were premonitions of the death of a loved one, for instance. And a very common response to a premonition of a death or a disaster is, could I have stopped this? Could I have prevented this from happening? Did I somehow cause it? Because people don't understand what it means to have a premonition. And so I realized I needed to write a book dedicated to this topic and debunk a lot of the myths that appear in ESP books and talk about what, you know, I think we can say with confidence about the topic of precognitive dreams at this point and how it works, or how it probably works roughly, and give people a kind of guide and reassurance that, hey, you know, there's a way in which all prophecy is self-fulfilling in some way. This is one of the key topics, and it gets to this topic of time loops, which is this the title of my first book. That circularity, that causal circularity, is key to the topic. And one of its implications is that, bottom line, you should never feel guilty if you have a dream or some kind of experience that seems to foretell something bad happening, and then it happens, and you should never feel guilty about that. And why you shouldn't feel guilty about that is takes up a lot of the real estate in my second book, Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. But all that to say, my main interest, honestly, is not dreams, but creativity, because I think precognition manifests in all kinds of ways. And dreams are kind of a niche subject. You know, a lot of people are really interested in dreams, but most people really aren't that interested in dreams. A lot of people, you know, think they don't dream because they don't remember their dreams. And, you know, it's hard to get them interested in the topic of precognition if you're just talking about dreams. But everyone can understand creativity and art. And so that's what the subject of my new book, From Nowhere, is really, you know, applying what I've learned about precognition to the subject of creativity, inspiration, you know, thinking about inspiration as an essentially precognitive phenomenon. And and then sort of not only talking about famous cases of novels predicting disasters, you know, like the famous novel that predicted the Titanic disaster. You know, there's a lot of examples like that. But going deeper into the lives of artists and seeing how their work may be precognitive or premonitory of very personal upheavals in their lives that you would only know if you knew something about their lives. You know, it's like, you know, most artists are precognizing things that happen to them personally. And so you kind of have to know a bit about the biography of the artist. So I sort of take a very biographical approach to the subject. I think you have to take a biographical approach to the subject, whatever you're studying, whether it's dreams, art, whatever. These are very much about our lives, about our upheavals in our lives, upheavals in our future lives. This concept of the long self, there's something we can talk about. I mean, this notion that we are four-dimensional creatures and that the landscape of our lives has these, you know, peaks and valleys, and these peaks are what capture the precognitive imagination, and the peaks ahead of us are influencing us right now in all kinds of ways. So that's a long answer to whatever you asked me 20 minutes ago.
It's all good. So I wrote down, as you were talking, I wrote down a few things. As a researcher, I'm mostly focused on this owl UFO thing, though I have taken a big step back I felt like I was clinging to that too much. I feel like I really grappled with that, and I feel like I did a lot of good work on that. But So it's still the owl is kind of centric to it, and then it's other birds and stuff like that. So I've loosened up on that too. But it's not just UFOs. So it would be, the short list for me would be UFOs, meditation. I got a lot of stories of owls and meditation.
And I've got a lot of stories of owls and psychedelics, most particularly involving mushrooms. Now, I have some outlying examples of ayahuasca, and you would think that would be right up there, but there are very, very few.
That might be out there. People simply haven't reached out to me with those. And then shamanic initiation. I've got a lot of stories about owls showing up at the time of shamanic initiation. And then owls and death. So I have very few. I have some of premonitions of death or foreshadowing of death that somehow involves an owl. And an owl for me has since become just a shorthand for, let's say, the highly charged human experience, of which all of these are. Or let me say the transformative experience within a human's life. So the owl is shorthand for that transformational process in someone's life. Now, so these five events, UFOs, psychedelics, meditation, shamanic initiation, and death, all, there's a sort of mystical quality to those. I call those highly charged human experiences. I'm also doing a lot of near-death research where I'm talking to people who have had near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. Surprisingly, no owls. There might be owl stories out there, but they're not directly associated with that. So I want it to fit. It should fit. It feels like it would fall into that list, but it doesn't. So,
well, that's an interesting datum right there. Yeah.
I'm baffled by it. Yeah. Oh, and so the questions I ask people when they have these experiences and they come to me in any kind of, you know, mishmash of these things I've listed, including owls and, let's say, other powerful sort of premonition events. It doesn't have to be owls, but there's usually some sort of dream language element that's at play in these stories. Mm-hmm. But the questions I ask is, what was going on in your life leading up to the event?
Yep, absolutely.
And what was going on after? What changed after? And then the other questions I asked is, how has your religion changed or your spirituality changed?
Right.
How would you rate your psychic abilities? And do you have healing abilities? So that's pretty much all I'm interested in. I used to ask, and you were talking about the creative thing, I used to ask, are you a creative type? And I stopped asking because everyone said yes. It just was like, get 100%. And I was like, okay, well, it's not going to do any good to ask that question if everyone says the same answer. So for you, the question would be, you had this UFO sighting event, these orange dots in the sky, and this took place in 2009. And let me ask this in two parts. How closely related was that UFO sighting
in Philadelphia
to getting that academic paper on the cyclical research?
It was about 2 years separated.
Oh, okay.
Those. Okay. Yeah. Bem's paper came out in 2011.
Which came first?
The UFO sighting came in 2009, but it was a very significant year for me. I mean, it happened right in the, like, as a bunch of big life upheavals were about to happen. My, you know, girlfriend broke up with me like a month later or 2 months later. And then my father died like about 4 months later. And I went through this, you know, grieving process where I became a painter. You know, I'd never, you know, done painting or visual. I mean, I'd been a photographer, but I'd never done painter. But my dad in his retirement had gotten into painting, oil painting. And he was the kind of person who, like, collected every possible, you know, he would buy every possible supply for whatever hobby of the moment, you know? And so the basement was full of supplies for his various hobbies, but he had all this great art supplies, all these great, you know, easels and paints and just everything you need. So, you know, I basically ported all of his art supplies back to Washington, D.C., where I was living. And I got really into painting UFOs for about 6 months. I painted Yeah, painted, you know, enormous canvases of UFOs. And that picture that appears on the nightshirt, that's just like a little detail of one of my UFO paintings that's upstairs. You know, my house is plastered with them. I think my, you know, wife secretly hates it, but whatever. I mean, but, you know, I was working through these losses in my life through painting, basically, and got very, you know, just obsessed, you know, and it's like a lot, you know, I would stay up all night, you know, painting these canvases, you know, with, you know, the influence of alcohol, unfortunately, and, you know, just, but very, you know, very intensely involved in this. And then 6 months later, I painted my last painting and I was done.
Oh,
I haven't touched the oil paint since.
Man.
I was just, you know, it was a thing that happened. I would love to get back. You know, I've had ideas for paintings, and if I had, now I'm a different house. I don't really have a good space for an atelier, but, you know, I would love to get back to it. But so, you know, yes, that UFO sighting happened. You know, it seemed to precede a death. It preceded, you know, it inaugurated a period of intense, a certain kind of creativity. I mean, I was already creative in other realms. I was already a writer and so on, but, you know, it opened a new kind of creative door for a while. And that's what led me. It's what prepared me then to take the topic of psychic phenomena seriously 2 years later when I, you know, when Daryl Bem's article came across my desk and so on. And I got then into the topic of precognition, which has dominated my life, since then. So yeah, it was a very significant point of inflection in my life. And even more significantly than that, the fact that it was directly over my favorite art museum, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and a number of the works that I talk about in my new book about art happened to be in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And, you know, it feels like a significant, almost sacred place for me. You know, I don't get to Philadelphia that often. It's like, you know, a 3-hour drive from where I live, 3.5-hour drive. But, you know, the fact that I then went on to write a book about art and creativity and somehow, yeah, it's weird in all kinds of ways.
So you were at a concert?
Yeah, actually, it was July 4th. There's kind of a green belt sort of that extends out in front of the museum for a long ways. And people camp out there see the fireworks. So there were a lot of people camped out on that kind of long green belt area waiting for fireworks. And there was a Sheryl Crow concert. Sheryl Crow was playing on the steps of the art museum. We were too far away. I couldn't even see. We could hear the music. We couldn't even see Sheryl Crow. I subsequently found out that Sheryl Crow was really interested in UFOs. I subsequently found out about that later. But the fireworks had not started yet at this point. And I tried to film it. I had one of those flip cams that they sold for a few years, and I tried to film it, but it just didn't show up on my camera. But the sighting itself was not anything, you know, it was not an up close and personal kind of encounter. But you know, it just got me to do my reading is what it essentially did.
Great. So I'm just going to, I wrote a lot down as you were talking here, and I'm going to address some of this here. The fact that you were drawing and painting UFOs is very common in sightings and things like that. So that fits a pattern very clearly. You must be aware of that. And then I'm going to say, I've come to look at the UFO, or let's say even a synchronicity in real life, as if it was dream language, in the sense that if you told me the story of the UFO sighting at the Sheryl Crow concert, and you told it as a dream, then I would interpret it as a dream. If I was the Jungian analyst and I was like, oh, so Sheryl Crow, a crow is a bird. And so in some like Native American traditions, crows and ravens are essentially the same bird paired.
Right.
They're sort of on the same spectrum in their totem element.
Right.
And so owls are the raven of the night, and ravens and crows are the owl of the day. So they have the same position. This is something I struggle with, but I would say owls fly at night. They represent the shadow.
ravens and crows fly during the day. They represent, you know, the bright sunshine, the conscious realm. The owl would represent the unconscious realm. That's easy to say. It doesn't line up in the reports I'm getting so cleanly. I wish it did, but it doesn't. I'm going to also say I worked as a professional illustrator all my life. I like, as a little kid, I would like do posters for like little events. And I was like a 12-year-old. So like I've been a professional illustrator, maybe 62. So that's 50 years. I've been a professional illustrator for 50 years. Except when I started doing the books right around 2014, I put all my energies into the books. I stopped drawing completely, zero. Like that was like my identity. My life was being an illustrator. And I mean, I was still, it was a creative process, but when you said, oh, there came a day, you just stopped. I stopped. I still, people ask me to do a little drawing every once in a while. I usually try to say no, but every once in a while I'll do something. And I've done book covers and things like that. That's something totally different than drawing. But essentially it's been zero for the last decade, which blows my mind. At the same time, I feel like I'm pouring my creativity into other resources. Yeah. So I understand that completely.
Well, I think that, you know, there may come a day when suddenly comes back, you know, and you have, you're suddenly filled with inspiration to do drawing again. I'm, you know, like, I've been a photographer all my life, but it comes in waves, and it comes every, well, it used to be roughly every 10 years, I would suddenly get really excited about photography, and often with some kind of old technology that I was just rediscovering. You know, it was, you know, around 1999, 2000, I was taking a lot of pictures with toy cameras like Holgas and these cheap Russian toy cameras. I was really into that kind of look of kind of cheap toy cameras and especially large format stuff. You know, I got really into it for a while and then, you know, just set it aside for about 10 years, then got into digital photography, you know, very intensely for a couple years and then nothing. And then about 10 years later, I dug out my parents' old Polaroid, SX-70, and just got really into Polaroids. And then I had it refurbished. I bought a new refurbished Polaroid, and like, I was just taking, you know, endless Polaroids for a couple of years. And then it kind of like subsided. And so, you know, so I know that I'm gonna, I know that there's going to be a photography wave that comes, you know, maybe in a few more years, who knows. But, yeah, I find that with different media, you go through these waves. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure your drawing wave will come again.
Well, I'm not predicting the future, and I'm not worried about that. And my plate is full right now, and I feel like I'm doing good work. So I'm not worried about that in the slightest.
Yeah.
I talk to people all the time so you described beautifully the mess of the UFO community
and the totality of it. So I feel like I'm very fortunate in the sense that I've got one, like it's chaotic, this thing, but I've got one little thread that I'm pulling, and I'm pulling on the owl thread. I'm asking for owl stories, and people are sending me these owl stories, and you're getting these precognitive dreams. Is arriving in your email inbox, or people contacting you through letters and, you know, direct conversations and phone calls. I know just what that feels like. You've got your specialty. I've got mine. I know just what that feels like. And there's a similarity between the stories that you must like totally tap into. I've called it the flavor and mood. Like people will send me an owl story that's powerful, like magical. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I have never heard that story exactly, but I've heard many with the same flavor and mood.
Heard a variant of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'm also talking to people who have had the direct contact experience, what we do call abduction. And I have talked to thousands of people who claim that experience. And if you read the literature, John Mack and Bud Hopkins and such, you would think, oh, I'm taken from, you know, a lonely road at night in my car, and then I end up on a table on a flying saucer, and these creepy medical exams take place. I've heard that almost not at all from people. I've heard it a little bit. It's part of it. But essentially, that is 0% of what I'm hearing. What I am hearing is people are describing synchronicities of such transformative power, of such emotional power, of synchronicities of such enormity that it totally throws their life off kilter. And that's consistent. That is overwhelmingly the consistent thing that I'm hearing, more than like, you know, scoop marks on their body or burn marks in the lawn. And it, there's something that comes out where it feels like these synchronicities are of such a power that it feels like it has been orchestrated by some outside force. And so, I mean, just speak to that. Not just the, I'm not just talking about the, you know, oh, I was thinking of Bob and then Bob called me on the phone. That's like a lower tier of what I'm talking about. You must understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing that kind of stuff within your research?
Let's see. That's a good question. I don't get a lot of like super high strangeness kind of stuff. I mean, people get the sort of narrow scope of what I study, which is precognitive experiences. And a lot of, as you just mentioned, with the idea of like, oh, I thought of someone and then I saw that, that kind of what is typically called a synchronicity, I would say, well, that's precognition. That's our ordinary, you know, we have this precognitive, I don't even call it a capacity because that makes it sound like a superpower or something like that. It's part of how our mind, brain, whatever you want to call it, functions. And it has been swept under the rug and denied since the Enlightenment. Okay. And there's all kinds of interesting reasons culturally, societally, institutionally, so on, why that is the case. And that's a big kind of sub theme running through my writing. But you know, what I'm trying to wake people up to is that a lot of what they're calling synchronicities are their own, you know, it's their own long self communicating with them. They are orienting without their knowledge, they're unconsciously orienting towards significant, meaningful encounters in their future. Sometimes it's their very near future, like, you know, a couple hours from now or the next day or next week. Sometimes though it's, you know, decades, you know, in the future. Nevertheless, it's partly an orienting function, and it's just, and it's natural. I don't even like the term paranormal for it anymore because it's so normal. Everyone experiences it, but most people don't realize they're experiencing it. But as far as the kind of like overwhelmingly, you know, the kind of big synchronicities you're talking about, I don't get a lot of that. I don't know. Maybe as we're talking, I'll think of some examples. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's not most people, you know, they read my work and they get, okay. So this thing that I was calling a synchronicity is really precognition. And I get those kinds of stories, you know, all the time. And I experience them daily. I'm not even, you know, it's the point. It's like you with owls. It's like, you know, it's not, I mean, these are great stories, but they don't surprise you, I'm sure, in any slight bit because yep. This is how it works. This is it. This mm-hmm. is it. I don't get a lot of real kind of real weird high strangeness kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I'm honestly glad because I don't know what I would do with it. I'm glad that people of greater capability such as yourself are handling that aspect of it. Go ahead.
Oh no, I'm handling it poorly sometimes. Like I feel like I'm overwhelmed. So, but I'm doing my very best. Keep going.
Yeah. No, but I think one of my beefs with the UFO scene, you know, the last couple decades is as I've learned more about precognition and realized how prevalent and how central it is to who we are, honestly, just as I think as biological creatures. I'm actually a materialist about precognition. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, this is something we will, you know, it has a naturalistic, physicalistic explanation. I mean, it involves quantum physics, but it's an aspect actually of our bodies. You know, our bodies are four-dimensional. They extend through time, and our consciousness is what's actually flat. It's kind of like it marches across the length of our long body, our long self, you know, but our consciousness is pretty confined, you know, to the present moment or something, you know, some semblance of the present moment. And it's very rare when we have a broader, you know, when we can somehow grasp the broader extent of our, or of any portion of our long self. So for me, it's kind of a, you know, it's really a physical unconscious phenomenon. But it's so huge and so much a part of who we are as human beings, that it frustrates me that it gets lumped with UFOs, and people assume that somehow, oh, they have a synchronicity or whatever, that this is somehow the phenomenon, when it's often, not always, but often it's them. Mm-hmm. And I had an interesting conversation actually on the last podcast I was on. This was a conversation with Luciano Volpe of the Behind Greatness podcast, but we were talking about this question. Well, what is it about UFOs that, you know, causes precognitive experiences? And I pointed out that, you know, people have precognitive experiences and synchronicity storms and that kind of thing around a lot of different life upheavals and transitions. It's not just paranormal ones, you know, deaths, falling in love is a great example. You know, when people fall in love, it's like, oh my God, you're suddenly, everything is synchronistic and everything is, the cosmos is aligning. So I would love, you know, to think more deeply about, well, what is the relationship between these kinds of typically paranormal topics like UFOs and so on, and I don't want to say mundane, but just, you know, ordinary, you know, life transitions that are, you know, super meaningful, just incredibly meaningful experiences, even if they don't have necessarily a paranormal dimension to them. Nevertheless, there are a lot of things in common between, like, grieving or falling in love or whatever, and seeing this light in the sky that changes your life. You know, all these things can really change your life, and synchronicity goes along with it, you know. And that's something that, you know, Jung would have totally agreed with. You know, I'm always trying to kind of probe that question. You know, the expression in science is cutting nature at the joints. You know, like, what are the proper joints to be cutting this UFO topic at? You know, because are we lumping in with UFOs something that actually is a lot bigger, that goes along with all kinds of life transition? Mm-hmm. And that UFOs, you know, are one kind of life transition, but not the only one. So I don't know. I mean, that's one of my, you know, I'm always trying to remind people that synchronicities and precognition happen. They're part of us, you know. It's something we're bringing to the UFO encounter or the, you know, the paranormal experience often. Maybe not always, but often. What would you say to that?
Well, so the term I would use is highly charged human experience.
Right, sure.
Which a UFO is most certainly one. And so, and then I would also say that an owl sighting sort of falls into that,
yeah,
in a way too, where people, you know, see an owl. Owl is a striking bird. It's got a lot of majesty, and
right,
everyone recognizes that. So I'm looking at the highly charged human experience. And so have you ever read of anyone or talked to anyone who's had a near-death experience or a psychic experience or a psychedelic experience or a UFO contact event, and they say, when I was in that realm, I knew everything in the universe? Have you come across that at all?
Well, like Elizabeth Krohn, do you know her?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, she would be an example of someone I've talked to who would fit that description. I have not talked to a lot of people about their near-death experiences. That's not a theme that people generally share with me.
Well, Elizabeth Krohn is a good example. I mean,
I only know her via Jeff Kripal, you know, and his work. So I didn't, you know, she didn't reach out to me with her experience. I got in touch, you know, I communicated with her because Jeff Kripal introduced us, and he had already written about her experiences in some of his writings. But as far as people reaching out to me and telling me stories directly, no, I haven't heard that a lot.
Okay. So I have, I get, so yeah, I get that, where someone says, I knew everything in the universe. It's rare, but
But it's a little, it's a striking moment. What then they follow that up with the next sentences, but I can't remember it now. But I did.
Well, that is super. I am so glad you mentioned that, because that is, I was just thinking about this the other day with, so I'm writing about Phil Dick, for instance, in new book. And people so often have these experiences where they feel like they've downloaded something.
Oh, yeah.
Something incredibly significant. It's often associated, right? It's often associated with what they may interpret as a paranormal or a UFO experience, or may interpret it as some encounter with some non-human intelligence, but they'll feel like they've downloaded something, but they don't know what it is, you know? And I think that's really interesting in all kinds of ways. And I don't know what to make of it, but the idea that they've downloaded something and they feel like it's already in there, but they need to then somehow unpack or decode it. That's a natural intuitive way of interpreting this from nowhere experience. And the title of my book is because artists so often describe inspiration as coming from nowhere. It's like a thought that comes into their head and they don't recognize it as their own. So it's very easy to interpret it as, well, this came from, you know, the gods. It came from the spirits. It came from a UFO. It came from something else. But there are interesting reasons why precognitive information from our own future, would feel that way, would feel like it's not coming from my own head. The reason is a term in psychology called source monitoring. We are able to sort of tell where our ordinary train of thoughts comes from because it follows our train of thoughts, and we know where our memories come from because they match, you know, they correspond to other memories of our past. But you suddenly have an image, you know, the example I use in my book, you know, Time Loops, is like, you know, if I suddenly had this mental image of riding a bicycle through Beijing, China, you know, which is a place I've never been, I would just discard that. I would just throw it out because, well, I've never been to China. That can't be a memory. And it would, of course, never occur to me that, oh, maybe in 10 years I'll be in China riding a bicycle, you know, down the streets. You know, we haven't been to the future yet. And so we can't recognize these thoughts that come into our heads from our future. We can't source monitor that. So they get either shunted aside or they get attributed to some other intelligence. And maybe sometimes they are from another intelligence. I'm not discounting that possibility, but precognitive information has that characteristic. And I'll give you an example. Well, we talked about Jeff Kripal. I mean, he always talks about his experience in Calcutta in 1988, where he was participating in a festival of the goddess Kali. He's exhausted from the festivities and all that. He lays down in bed and suddenly feels electricity running down his body, and his consciousness is pulled out of his body like by a magnet, and he gets a download. Like, he just feels like his body has been overwhelmed with information, and he doesn't know what that information is upon waking or after the experience is over. He doesn't know what that information was that he was given. But then in subsequent decades, he realized, oh, those were my books. You know, those are the books that I've been writing, you know? So he interpreted it as, you know, this was essentially a precognitive inspiration experience that manifested as a goddess, you know, standing on his chest and pulling his consciousness out of his body. But it was his future, you know, it was his future self. It was his future authorial self, which he was engaged. He was in a time loop. He was in a time loop with his future. You know, I think that recognizing that things can feel out of nowhere, but they're from somewhere. They're from you, but a future you that you haven't been to yet. You know, so this is what fascinates. I mean, this is the story of the long self and our confused relationship to our long self is what, you know, it really grips me and fascinates me. It certainly doesn't exhaust the realm of paranormal phenomena by any means. And it can't tell us what UFOs are. I don't think UFOs are our future selves, but I think aspects of of significant, what was the term you used?
Highly charged human experience.
Highly charged human experiences. Yes. Those, what I would call the peaks in our future lives.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Are signaling to us like a signal flare on those mountains. You know, they're in our heads now. And when we open to that possibility and realize, oh, you know, maybe this, you know, this, I should pay attention to that image of riding through the streets of Beijing, you know, somehow that might come true in my life, you know, in some weird way. And realizing that as a possibility kind of changes how we think about these kinds of experiences. So that was another long answer to a question I no longer even remember.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's let me start over again. I've been a guest on many, many podcasts, and I know just what that means to, like, you start going around the block and then you forget where you started. And yeah.
So where you started. Yeah, right.
So I don't know who coined the term, but there's a Dr. James Hollis. Are you familiar with him? He's a Jungian analyst.
Mm-hmm. He's a Jungian.
Yeah. He's written some beautiful books, and he uses a term which I love. It's mythopoetic. And there's something, the archetypal images that seem to arise in this lore, and that the dream language that seems to arise in this lore, and this goes back to those five things and the six things, if you include the near-death experience that I listed off earlier as the highly charged human experiences that seem to be making themselves known in my direct research as I loosen my grip on owls and allow myself to take a wider picture of these things. Hey, I got to ask, I'm good buddies with Chris Knowles. Mm. You reference him in your recent book.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. Good researcher. I don't know him personally. We've interacted in the past, you know, on occasion via Twitter usually. He does really great, you know, deep dives into, you know, synchronicities, and has done, you know, really fascinating delving into, you know, comic artists like Jack Kirby. And you know, we're both big Cocteau Twins fans, and he's, of course, done a series on
Elizabeth Frazier.
Yeah. Now, he interprets that whole thing in a different idiom than I do. I mean, I'm not a synchromystic in the sense that Chris Knowles is. You know, I view it through a different lens, but he finds, you know, incredible connections that are, you know, really fascinating to think about. So yeah, I quote him a few times.
Yeah, and mythopoetic, it would be that it's the mythos of the pop culture is like,
yeah,
mm-hmm, taking on this poetic urgency. And wow, that guy is on fire with this research. So
right,
it really. Mm-hmm. So he's been a friend of the show, and I've done a bunch of interviews with him, mm-hmm, when I had the previous incarnation of this podcast, and he's on my list to talk with soon enough. Hey, before we started, before we clicked the record button, I mentioned Mac Tony.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great friend of mine, and I wrote a full chapter about Mac in my third book, which was a sort of memoir of my experiences, and that chapter gets more, people reference that chapter so much.
I need to read that. Yeah, I haven't read that.
Yeah, I can send you the chapter.
Yeah, please do.
But it's basically my interactions with him and the synchronicities that took place around us and around his death. It's typical of synchronicities. They have a kind of loopy logic where, mm-hmm, you pull on one thread and then you drag in something that you didn't expect, or the tapestry is wound so tight sometimes in a synchronicity.
Right.
You call it a synchronicity storm, and that's something I understand very well. He wrote a book called After the Martian Apocalypse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love that book.
And that was based on the Viking mission that took the photograph that's the ubiquitous face on Mars. And that's been the center point of all kinds of conjecture and conspiracy stuff. And I'm like, I don't know quite what to make of it, though I'm dazzled by, I love reading about it and speculating on things. I don't know what the real story is. Mac Tonies was born on the day the Viking mission was launched. This was in 1976. It launched from Cape Canaveral. And he was born on the day that the spaceship went into outer space, went to orbit Mars, and took that photograph. Mac Tonies was born on the day of the launch, which I find not so much remarkable, but it's the kind of thing I have come to expect in this mystery. Like if I put that in a fiction story, no one would believe it, but it happened in real life, and we're, you know, these kinds of mythopoetic elements show up in the real life. Oh, and we also talked about the book The Crypto-Terrestrials. That was Mac's book that was published posthumously, and you were very complimentary of that book when we talked just before the recording button was pushed, before we started this interview.
Yeah. Well, on the Mars thing, I mean, I have a part of my, one of my chapters is about the face on Mars and, you know, three artists who precognized it very clearly, that that image, and not only the image, but the surrounding, what I call the meme complex that surrounds the face on Mars, the idea that it's the remnant of a of an ancient apocalypse on Mars. Three separate artists in the years prior to, years and decades prior to the Viking missions, very clearly precognized that. So that's part of my book. I don't know if you were, that's why you brought that up or not.
Oh, yes, yes. That's exactly why I brought it up.
Yeah. But yeah, and, but I, yeah, I love his books. I mean, I love both that book on Mars and the Crypto-Terrestrials. I think the Crypto-Terrestrials is one of the best books ever in ufology. And I'm so glad, as I said before we started recording, I'm so glad that people are finally kind of remembering that book and paying attention to it, because I think he really, I don't know what the reality, the UFO reality is, but I suspect it's something close to what, if I had to guess, I would say that, that Tani's was on the right track.
So I've spoke with Mac at length about that book while he was writing it. And we were also talking about the illustrations in the book. I ended up doing the illustrations, the chapter headers in the book. He was very clear in the personal conversations and the talking on podcasts at the time. He doesn't quite say it so much in the book. It's in there, but he took on this idea of the crypto-terrestrials as a concept where these beings, these intelligences, are not from another planet. They are somehow sharing our reality with us, though they might have these highly evolved abilities, and these might be psychological or they might be technological abilities to cloak themselves, hide themselves, just to remain out of phase with our normal reality. And he very clearly said it was a thought experiment. I just was treating it as a thought experiment. And I just, you know, like it had some legs. And so I wrote this little book on it. The book is short. It's like, I think it's like 79 pages or something like that. And I will also say for people listening out there, it is available as an audiobook. And it's a quick little audiobook. And the reader did a great job. And so I have since reread it through the audiobook process, actually, where I listened. And I was blown away again. And I won't go into it here, but there's a bunch of weird synchronistic overlap that took place directly connected with Mac and that book and his death. And so it's a really emotionally charged and very real thing for me. I will also add that I wrote a novel recently, as far as like I've talked about giving yourself over to the creative process. Wow, do I have some stories there as far as like, you know, I had a vision of a story, and then I started writing, and the story took on a life of its own and just led me to go. But Mac was very much a character in the book, but like 100%, it's not hidden. I call him Tony. It's him. And everyone who, and so, and I sent that book. I communicated a lot with Mac's mom after he died. And this is now, that was 2009, so that's 14, almost 15 years ago. And I sent the book to his mom, the fiction book where I created a fictional character. And the feedback I'm getting from the book is, my sister read the book. She doesn't know anything about this kind of research I'm doing. She basically said, I loved your book. I didn't understand it. And one of the things she said is like, oh, I loved the character Tony. So it was really a really touching thing for me that you just, so that felt great. So I just want to thank you for praising his book, deservedly so.
Yeah, I've got it. Actually, I pulled it out a few weeks ago. It's sitting in my, you know, my office is piles of books everywhere, but I pulled it out from my library a few weeks ago because I would like to reread it I think it's really important and very important book. It's not only a good book, it's an important book.
I agree, 1,000%. And I'm doing my best to make sure that it doesn't drift into the forgotten books on a dusty bookshelf, that it stays alive and vital.
Right.
So would you read a passage from your upcoming book? We spoke a little bit beforehand, and I noted just a short excerpt from what would be page 329 of the, mm-hmm. the electronic version of the book you sent. Mm-hmm. And this one, the reason I'm asking you to read this is it had a real, I resonated very strongly with this short segment.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So this is actually from the last page, I think, of the book. It's the afterword where I get more personal in the afterword and talk about my own experiences and I talk, a little bit about, a lot of my experiences, tangent UFOs and ufology, and I have a, significant precognitive experience around Jacques Vallée, for instance, that I talk about. But yeah, this is from the last page of the book, and I'll just read the portion that you had highlighted. Many who see UFOs realize then and there that their lives are bigger and more serious than they had previously imagined. Their imagination quickly enlarges, and they often feel called upon to be better and to do better. Indeed, the anomalous lights I saw over the art museum had the same message for me that a radiant, antique-sculpted torso of the god Apollo had for the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke in one of his most beloved poems, You Must Change Your Life. Experiencing precognition in dreams and creativity has a similar effect, making you want to change your life. Seeing firsthand the reality that you are a long self in a block universe reinforces the value both of your own and of all the other long selves whose biographies interweave with yours to make up the tapestry of our civilization. In my last book, written in the shadow of American atrocities at home, I wrote of a long self-revolution, awakening to the vastness of our lives as a way of awakening to the vastness and value of each other's, a revolution of imagination and care, of empathy and anti-cruelty. So if there is a moral or ethical implication of my argument, it is this: you must change your life in this life, not wait for the next one.
Thank you so much for that. In my research, I stepped into this not quite knowing what the owl and UFO would lead to. And the book I wrote, the first book, The Messengers, proved to be, upon its completion, I tried my very best to stay neutral. And what emerged was a sort of, I don't want to say benevolent book, but I will say a hopeful book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that surprised me. I did not expect that. So there is something interwoven within this mystery. Maybe it's something that's interwoven within the psyche of myself and maybe in yours, given what you just read there. But there is something benevolent within this mystery. Benevolent might be the wrong word. I'm going to go back to hopeful. I think that's a better word. Benevolent makes me think of, candy-colored unicorns on a pink cloud or something like that. But hopeful is something that I think we can all strive towards.
Absolutely. The term that my friend who appears in my second book has a whole chapter devoted to her experiences, and I know you know her because we were on an email exchange a few years ago. Toby Watery is her name. She, incredible precog, amazing precognitive dream experiences her whole life. But she uses the word care. The word that comes to her is the word care. And when she said that in one of her early emails to me, is like, oh, that's it. That hits the nail on the head for me. It's about care. And to get in touch with these, call them abilities, but they're really just, to become aware of the operation of these, of this whole dimension of our lives, it requires caring. Caring, for self, obviously, but caring for others is crucial. And so that, I think, goes along with what I'm trying to say in that passage, I think, and what I take you as saying about hopefulness. There's really some way in which this can be a compass, I think, for benevolence, in the world, in a world that desperately needs some more benevolence.
Yeah, I agree. And it's this research is a Rorschach test in a way, mm-hmm. right? It's a collection of disparate, chaotic elements that we're you and I are both in our separate researches, I feel like, are struggling to make sense of this scatterplot mm-hmm. and to see the patterns in there. And I wonder whether it's my own nature to have this emerge, to have this aspect emerge, or whether it's truly in there. And yeah. And here's what I'll say. This is, I want it to be in there. So I'm proceeding forward as if it is in there. Mm-hmm. And then I try to keep myself in check as best I can. But I know that I'm predisposed to want to see the good in this.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Hey, so we've been at it for about an hour and 15 minutes here. Like, we can wind this down a little bit. In 2002, you were on stage at Rice University, and I was in the audience. And this was at Jeffrey Kripal's Archives of the Impossible conference. And you were addressing the audience, and you said something to the effect of, you're there, and you turned around, you pointed to the wall behind you, and you said, there was a big screen, and it had the logo for the conference, and the logo for the conference had these big owl eyes. I'll also add that Rice University is awash in owls. That's the mascot of the school, so you can't walk through the campus without seeing an owl statue, an owl logo, or some student walking by with an owl t-shirt. And you said something to the effect of, like, I this owl stuff, like, it's right there, it's all over the thing, and Mike Clellan's in the audience. And like, I can't help but think how strange this is. And you spoke and made a point right now, this is going back 2 years ago, I can't exactly remember what you said. So what were you getting at when you said that?
Okay, well, I said that you were going to beat me up after, because I made some kind of snarky comments about owls, because I was like, at that point, my daughter was really into owls for like 2 years. She was, she would have been like six at that, or five or six at that point. And like, oh my God, our house was full of owls. And I, in the process of learning about owls, yeah, I learned so much about owls. And I was like, you know, I was like steeped in the kind of science of owls. And I just kind of wanted to counter the kind of mystique around owls. And so I was being kind of snarky with the knowledge that you were in the audience. And I was trying to kind of poke you a little bit in a friendly way. But what I was suggesting, and here's, you know, this is a total thought experiment. I don't necessarily believe this, but what fascinates me is how images and archetypes reflux in culture backwards in time. In fact, the what I'm suggesting in the new book is that that may be what archetypes are. You know, Jung thought they were from a phylogenetically ancient reservoir of symbolism or whatever. They're from our ancestral past. But what if we flip that? I mean, I show in the book so many cases where what an archetype type thing emerges from the kind of confused relationship to culture that precognitive people have. And they may interpret these images as belonging to the past when they're really part of this engagement with their future encounters with culture. And so in my books, I have lots of examples of retro cultural influence where, you know, an artist is influenced not only by maybe some event in their future biography or some disaster in the news, you know, the next day or something like that, but where they're influenced even by writers that they haven't even read yet. And that suggests the idea that through this kind of river of inspiration flowing through culture, that images from the future could retro flow into the past. And this is something I speculate a lot about in the last chapter of my book, that in like dream sharing communities, shamanic initiation traditions, things like that, you would have this retro flow of images from the future into the past. And that maybe that's what archetypes are. Archetypes are something in our future. So what I was suggesting, you know, what if, just as a thought experiment, you know, what if the whole, you know, role of owls in this whole paranormal thing, you know, that you have been mapping, you know, that's your thing that you've been mapping all these years, you know, and that Whitley Strieber in his experience kind of made central, I think, in his book. What if it's all a premonition of this moment, of this moment in this auditorium at Rice University in 2022, where Jeffrey Kripal and Jacques Vallée and Whitley Strieber and Mike Cleland are all in the audience here in this one room, probably the first time that had ever happened, that these people were all in the same room under the gaze of this gigantic owl, because randomly Rice University's mascot is the owl. You know, what if that, you know, that moment is what retrofluxed into the past, you know, creating kind of a strange attractor, you know, in the future of all these experiences, you know, centered on owls, you know, going back through history, you know, like the, you know, Chauvet Cave, you know, in France, there's an image of an owl on the wall. It's the oldest image of an owl ever in human art. You know, it's probably, what, 32,000 years old. What if that, what if that owl is there on Chauvet Cave because of a presentation at Rice University in 2022? I'm obviously, this is, you know, I don't necessarily believe this, but that's the kind of possibility I'm trying to open people to, that these significant images and archetypes are from our future, our collective future, and that the river of culture is not something that just flows in a forward direction, you know, as cultural traditions and influence and so on, but that these significant dream kind of images, you know, are significant cultural moments and historical moments in the future that are symbolically transformed and flow into the past via our individual precognitive capabilities and via the precognitive imagination of artists and religious visionaries and people taking ayahuasca in ritual settings in the Amazon and you know, people doing dream incubation in Greece or you know, prehistoric Paleolithic Europe. You know, what if? So that's the kind of thought experiment that I kind of end my book on. But that's what I was suggesting in that Rice seminar. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking about that yesterday, thinking about our conversation, and so I'm wondering if you harbored bitterness about that suggestion.
Oh no. no bitterness at all. None at all. What happened was then at some point the microphone got handed around the audience, and Whitley Strieber got handed the microphone. He stood up. He's got this big presence and this commanding voice. And he said, like, addressing the owl, I'm paraphrasing from memory. Like, he basically said, Mike Cleland wrote an important book. And I was like in the audience, like Jacques Vallée was in the room with us, and I'm like,
right,
like, yeah. Just like, I felt the conference came at the end of COVID. COVID was a rough time for me. I felt like I became a hermit in all the worst ways, and suddenly I was in this great big room full of people. That was like new for me. That was like an environment I should feel comfortable in, and I was like a little bit claustrophobic in all the intensity. So, like, I'm from New York City. I was prepping a comeback. Mm-hmm. It's like easy for me. And basically what I was going to say is like, don't worry, I'm not going to beat you up. That was my short comeback. And I think I had something a little more poetic that I was going to say also.
Yeah.
But when Whitley stood up and said that, I was like, oh God, like, I was totally flummoxed. Like, oh my God, this is real. This is happening. And then the microphone got handed around, and someone on the same aisle as me raised their hand to talk. Then some person who didn't know me at all hands me the microphone, and I have to hand it to the person down the thing. So I had the microphone in my hand, and you know, I'm staring at this thing like, do I talk in front of everyone? Like, right now, do I talk now? Right. So I didn't.
Yeah.
And the reason I didn't was I was just so thunderstruck by the graciousness of what Whitley had said. I mean, good grief, Whitley Strieber, Diana Pasulka, there were the people who were in that room, these heroes of mine. Jeff Kripal, good grief. You know, so I was just like, I was gobsmacked. And so it struck me mute, which is not my normal state, believe me. So yeah, so thank you for that. Hey, do you have a cat?
Got a cat. He's I think he's right outside the door here. Yeah.
Yeah. I heard him a little bit ago. So yeah. So, and we got roosters.
Yeah. I've been hearing the roosters the whole time. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, I gotta believe me. I love the eggs. I hate the roosters. So, yeah. So, so
We've been talking now for over an hour, and wow, we covered a lot. And at the same time, I still got a lot of questions I really want to ask you. I know your time is short. When we talked earlier, before the record button was pushed on this interview, I asked you if you had a story, a good story, just a story that would reflect the core of your research. And you said you did. And so, wow, I would really love to hear the kind of story that you feel reflects the work you're doing.
One of the guys who, he was an English guy who reached out to me, you know, this is a guy who reached out to me after Time Loops was published. And he was one of many people who's, you know, reached out to me, say, hey, I've had like some pretty amazing dream experiences. And, you know, and I used one of his dreams in the introduction to my Precognitive Dream Work in the Long Self book, but it was about a family member winning the lottery, you know, as a, and it was a dream in which he won the lottery, but couldn't retrieve it because it was stuck in a milk bottle. And it turned out that his family didn't win the lottery, but his cousin won the lottery, and this cousin was a milkman, and he didn't even know that. And it's like this, the dollar amount was the same in his dream as what the cousin, the milkman cousin won and all that. You know, it's just a very typical kind of dream where something significant happens, but it's not quite right. And it's not necessarily something that happens to you, but something that happens, you know, that you hear about or whatever. But anyway, he's just a couple of weeks ago, he sent me this new experience that he'd had. And he actually, it was just phenomenal. And it fits right into what I'm writing about now, which is, you know, I've shifted gears from dreams to creativity. And this is a creative precognitive experience he had as a child, which he just, it was a time loop that just fulfilled itself after something like 30 years. And it's incredible. And I can actually use his name, and he actually wrote it in a blog, and I could actually read from it. I wanted to just read from it because it's, he wrote this lovely little blog post about this experience.
Oh, great, great.
And let me just pull it up here. In the last year of my time at primary school, he writes. Oh, by the way, this man's name is Kevin Archer, and this is, you can find his blog post is called The Broken Arrow of Time. In the last year of my time at primary school, he writes, my teacher set the class a simple task, to imagine that we were living the life of a fictional ancestor at any point in history and to describe our experiences. I had often wondered about the origins of my surname, Archer, and I decided to position my imaginary self on a medieval battlefield. I think he's about 10 at this point, or 11. I wrote at length about my equipment, including my sword, bow and arrows. I waxed lyrical on my unwashed hair, dirty skin, and tattered clothing, and revealed the deep emotions that tormented an exhausted but resilient warrior. I recounted that I fought bravely, and I explained the tactics that helped us win the day against an army many times larger. I concluded by saying that it was such an astonishing and unexpected outcome that the king personally congratulated me on my martial skills. He smiled, patted my bow, and instructed me to adopt the surname Archer in memory of the victory. And then he says, he goes on to say that the teacher was so impressed by this story that he called his parents into school and told the parents that it was written with such clarity and conviction that he felt he had been transported back in time. He was astonished that a 10-year-old could produce this kind of writing and suggest that he become a historian or an author. Okay, so then he goes on to say that 40 years later, okay, this is four decades, so this, he must be about 50 now, his young daughter started asking questions about her heritage and wanted to know about where she came from. So he got interested in genealogy, and he connected with someone doing genealogical research on his family, and finds out from this genealogist, who turns out to be a relative of his, that he was descended from a man named Simon de Bois, who fought at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, and that he was an archer. And that Henry V awarded this ancestor an annual pension of 5 marks on the understanding that he changed his surname to Archer. So 40 years, and then he clarifies, later that day, I speak to my parents to check that they did not tell me any of this story when I was a child. My father made it crystal clear that he knew nothing of our history beyond the faint connection to the father he lost in the last days of World War II. So he knew nothing about the origins of his surname Archer, but wrote a story at age 10 explaining that he had fought on the battlefield and that he had done so well as an archer that the king required him to change his name to Archer. And then it found out that that was the actual origin of his name. And then he follows it up. And so it gets even better. So a lot of people might say, oh, well, maybe he's the reincarnation of that guy, that archer that fought on the battlefield. Well, in subsequent research, he found out that actually that idea that the Simon de Bois, the ancestor of these people, was, you know, given the name Archer after the Battle of Agincourt is actually a myth. That the name actually had an earlier origin than that. So it wasn't, you know, actually historically accurate, but it was an amazing learning experience that transformed, you know, changed his life at age 50, that he had written about 40 years earlier at age 10. And, you know, this is the kind of thing I love. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, to write a scene in a story that plays out a week later. It's another thing to write a scene in a story that plays out four decades later. But it happens. It happens all the time. I've got tons of examples of this kind of thing from famous artists and writers in my new book. But it happens with a 10-year-old doing a school assignment. So I just love that story and hope to use it in a future book or something, but it's online. You could read the blog. Anyway, that's what I'm talking about.
And these are the kinds of things I understand. I feel it in my bones. And I resonate so strongly with that story, or let's say that kind of story. And I think I said as much, maybe multiple times in this interview, but I need to say it again. You and I are not doing the same research, obviously, but we seem to be on a parallel track. And I just want to say thank you so much. This has been a great talk. And I don't think we actually talked. I think I said hello to you and shook your hand at the event at Rice University, but I don't think there was much beyond that. So I just want to say thank you so much. This has been great. And I resonate so strongly with your work and your ideas and the way you're presenting them. So thank you for talking today. And also thank you so much for all the hard work you've put into this research.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for the work you do. And actually, we spoke very briefly on one of the sidewalks on the campus before the event started. And literally less than 5 minutes later, I heard an owl in one of the trees on campus. I imagine that Rice University is named Rice because there probably are a lot of owls around. But it definitely was an owl and not like another bird, because I know what owls mm-hmm. sound like. And it was an owl. So I had an owl encounter shortly after meeting Mike Cleland on a path. So,
and so I'm you can see my face in the video here. I should be astonished, right? But what you're saying, I have heard so many times.
You've heard it so many times.
Oh, right. My word. Yeah. It's the reality is presenting itself in dream language for you and I, and I think everyone. The awareness to see it, I think, generates more synchronicities and more awareness. The volume turns up. It generates more of these types of experiences just by recognizing it and being in awe of these events. Okay, thanks so much. This has been great.
Great. Awesome. All right, well, this has been fun. I really enjoyed it.
I did too. This is Mike, and I am chiming in after the editing. First, let me say, I had a good set of questions for Eric, but I only really got around to asking a few of them. Conversations, especially conversations like this, tend to have a life of their own, and I much prefer that when they flow organically rather than what would be a formal interview. Now, it ended sort of abruptly for me as the host, but Eric had some other obligations that day, so we took it right up to the point where he needed to leave. And up until that point, it felt like we were really in a good groove. We really dug deep, and that's what I want in these conversations. But you, the listener, might have sensed the goodbye at the end felt a little bit rushed. And that's because it was. Let me also say that I did a lot of editing on this one to clear out the extraneous stuff, the things that weren't part of the core of our conversation. Now, I had a lot of questions that I never got to. And during the editing process, I sent him a note. And I said, hey, we didn't get to a lot of good stuff, and I feel like there's a whole lot more we could talk about, so we should do a part 2 of this conversation.
And he got back to me right away and said, yes, absolutely. So I foresee a follow-up conversation with Eric, and I might be precogging this strong sense of knowing from some future part of myself. Now, this is only the third episode I've recorded for this newer incarnation of the podcast. And please know, I want to generate some things specifically for the Patreon members, but I haven't yet gotten around to that. This format, this newer format, still feels new for me, and my short-term focus presently is just putting out some high-quality content. I will be adding some Patreon extras soon enough. So if you, the listeners, have any thoughts or ideas on what kind of content I could add, please send me a note, either through my website, which is mikeclellan.com, or through the Patreon site. And please do this whether you are a member or not. I'm really eager to know what kinds of things you want from this site, and I'm very open to anything you want to share. Now, one more thing. I'm using Patreon as the hosting site for this podcast, but I'm also using another site called Buy Me a Coffee, and I'm using this as sort of a tip jar. I think it's a little bit simpler as a companion or as an alternative to the Patreon site. And if you'd like to make a donation, even if it's just a little bit, one way to do it is to go to Buy Me a Coffee, all one word, and type in Mike Clelland, and I should come right up. My final note is about the roosters in the background. I have asked them to be quiet, but they don't seem to be listening. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.